me to be on page 118, Bet 118b. And we're on 118a3 is where we're going to start if you're in the art scroll. 118a3. And if you're not in the art scroll, I'm going to be starting today with the tripartite being spared at least from three misfortunes that we left off with at the end of last class. And I'm going to move through some of those and see where the Gemara goes in a midrashic kind of a way. We have been studying about the notion that from a particular verse, one part to remember before we jump into where we are today is that the Gemara, in discussing whether or not we save things from fires on Shabbat, moves into a focused discussion of what the delight of the Shabbat would be. A large-scale narrative, I believe what's happening here is that they started with Matzav HaChirum, an emergency situation, fires of the Sabbath. But everybody knows the fires of the Sabbath are supposed to just be a Sabbath candle, or some kind of Sabbath light, or the light by which you eat your meals. And it's important to recall that the discussion here, which is about the fires of Shabbat, and an emergency that a fire breaks out on Shabbat based on the fact that maybe your lamp spilled over, because you're talking about an oil lamp or some other type of fuel that's burning, ultimately spread to a dry spot in your home, or this kind of, or that kind of cloth that's near it, or whatever you've got going on in your house, that it's not an argument against having a lamp and fire and light in your house. So as I explained in the beginning of launching into the section, no matter where you are in Masechet Shabbat, one of the projects here is convincing all of us that Shabbat is a good institution. That the way we darshan and interpret possibilities for Shabbat are good. The way we understand them are right. And what we allow you to do on the Sabbath is also good and right, so that if someone came along and said that one ought to simply sit in the dark on a Sabbath evening, eat food that was cold the whole time through, we have an answer for that as the rabbis. And we allow for the kindling of a Sabbath light. And most likely, Talmudic times, the kindling of a Sabbath light to light up the space in which you ate your meal was a legal possibility within the culture. There are those who claim, by the way, that lighting two Shabbat candles and saying Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbat on them is 11th to 13th century. You're not talking about a fire that breaks out because somebody had a nice silver tray with beautiful candlesticks and they're kindling the Sabbath lights. Whether or not they kindled a light and felt that was the unique light of Shabbat in a certain place, probably that does go back a little bit earlier. The blessing itself may have been around a little earlier than some of the research says, but some of the research inclines us towards understanding that that bracha was a bracha that women themselves instituted in the same fashion or in the same pattern as what? The blessing over Hanukkah candles. Because it's in the Gemara, in Masechet Shabbat, that we get the Hanukkah candles and we understand that the bracha on Hanukkah candles is Baruch Atah Al Vahadlik Ner Shel Hanukkah, to kindle the lights of Hanukkah. And when you went to light the Hanukkiah, the candles of the Sabbath, you felt as though you could institute a similar blessing over that which was also a rabbinic ordinance, to light a light for Shabbat that was just for Shabbat. And the women of the Middle Ages, we don't have it at least in manuscript form or in a sidur or in the record of what Sabbath practice was until about the 11th or the 12th century. Now, that's not to say that you didn't have practice of saying some type of prayer over a Sabbath light. We just don't happen to have any extant. And I think that on a social, religious level, at least for myself, it's difficult to believe that it was simply said the first time in the Middle Ages when we have it in manuscript form. Not clear exactly when it was introduced, but it's definitely not in the Gemara.
And then about the kin, like you're saying, no bracha to go along with it.
Correct.
You see it, right?
Correct. Jay's making reference to the passage in the Gemara, with what shall we light the Sabbath lights, which is a passage we read on Friday nights, but is part of the Mishnah. And those Sabbath lights most likely were a lamp unique to the Sabbath, which gave you light enough to extend your light within the home. Fuel was a little bit more expensive. It wasn't as though they were lighting their domiciles every night, through the night, as in our culture. And there was discussion about what was kasher and what was not for this Sabbath light. And then heating food is a discussion in the Mishnah itself, and with what we can heat food and how we keep hot food becoming a cultural piece of what the Sabbath is going to look like in order to make the meals full of delight. And that's the part we really had seen the Gemara go into in our section. With the light of the Sabbath, fire in its right place, you're going to have a meal on Friday night, and whether you have three or four meals, remember, is part of the discussion that we had last time. And the place that the rabbis learned that you have three meals is, remember, derived on 117b. Well, you had three mentions of the word Hayom, and it's on 117b4 in the art scroll, if you're looking with me. Amar Rabbi Yochanan said, I'm on the right column, Ushneim Mikra Chad Darshu, two of them expounded on the same verse, Vayomer Moshe, Moses said, Ichluhu Hayom Ki Shabbat Hayom LaAdonai Hayom Lo Timtzuhu Basadeh. Moses said, eat it today, for today is the Sabbath to God. Today you shall not find it in the field. So that verse from Exodus becomes the verse in which three mentions of the word Hayom are used to say you have three meals on the Sabbath. Though there's a position you had four, remember we were pretty clear that it was absolutely three, and the whole discussion of the Gemara shows that, of course, we're interested in having the Talmudic debate, but we're pretty clear it's three. And the reason I bring you back to the verse is because I find it fascinating in Midrashic terms, sometimes the Gemara, and somebody I think mentioned this the last time, says, oh, well, I need that verse for my drash, so you're not allowed to use the verse for yours. A lot of times that happens when there's a law to adjudicate or debate. And what will be interesting about where we're launching in tonight in the Gemara is that at the core of the interpretive process within the page of Talmud we're about to launch into is this anchor this reference back to the verse that contains three mentions of Hayom, and nobody says, hey, wait a minute. You can't use this verse to learn these three things. Of course, it's not direct in its learning it out that way. It doesn't say you're spared three misfortunes based on the three mentions of the word Hayom. But if we're to take the spirit of a midrashic mindset and take the number three, which we've already learned is a halachic requirement for the number of meals we eat on the Sabbath, we're about to learn three, if you will, ways that Shabbat protects us as a community, protects our souls as individuals, and allows us to experience the world in as righteous and holy a way as possible. And I think that, again, it comes and stems from this notion that people went back to this very pasuk, this very verse from Exodus, and found it within the mentions of the 3 days. So, okay, so now we have that anchoring in the verse itself.
Back to the light of Shabbat. Did they have an oil lamp that they lit before sundown on Friday night and that burned throughout the time? Or are you saying that they were allowed to kindle on Shabbat another?
No. They kindled for the oncoming Sabbath a certain light that would be for the Sabbath light. So no kindling of lights during the Sabbath.
And you had said that, you know, they could, like, be in the dark and not warm things. Were there any people who said we shouldn't even do that, that we should be in the dark and not even have a light burning?
I mentioned that because that is the Karaitic approach to life. And so the Karaites were the group that from that period, probably or even earlier and forward, created a culture where the legal interpretations of the Torah were not based on any of the rabbinic understandings, and the Mishnah held no real authority within their community, though they were in dialogue with it. We know from recent findings in the Dead Sea Scrolls area that there were also halachic manuscripts, some of the oldest extant Jewish legal manuscript work evidenced in that community about the Sabbath shows that they had some different interpretations than the rabbis as well. So, yes, there are dialogues among groups that are not even Christianizing, but are different in their interpretation of holding Torah in high esteem when it comes to the way that they'll fulfill Sabbath law. Okay. So let's launch into where we were at the end of last class now. Given that background, a little bit of a preface, and say that we're going to avoid three misfortunes if you keep the Sabbath. And we're now back on 118. And we're going to Okay, 118A3, left-hand column. And by the way, it says the Gemara digresses to discuss the reward for observing three Sabbath meals. Yeah. I don't know if it's a digression. I think it's a different drush. So I would have said the Gemara works out a different midrash, presents a different midrash for the verse from Exodus regarding the three mentions of the word Hayom. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi said, Amar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Mishum Bar Kapra. In the name of Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, in the name of Bar Kapra. Kol HaMekayim Shalosh Sudot B'Shabbat. Whoever fulfills the precept of eating three meals on the Sabbath, Nitzol Mishalosh Poranuyot. Whoever fulfills the precept of eating the three meals is spared from three misfortunes. Michevle Shal Mashiach, from the travails of the Messiah. Midina shel Gehenim, and from the judgment of Gehenim, Milchamot Gog u'Magog, and from the war of Gog u'Magog. So three travails you will avoid in your life. And if you look at the Rashi on Chevle Mashiach, hold on 1 second. Chevle Shel Mashiach, Kida Amrinan beKetubot. Rashi brings you to a different place in the Gemara in Masech Ketubot. Dorish Shibin David Babo Kategoria B'Talmidei Chachamim Shneemar Va'od Ba Ashirei Chevle Lashon Chevle Yolada from Hosea. So Rashi is explaining to us that the Chevle Mashiach is the generation that will experience the coming of the Messiah. And Chevle Mashiach is kind of the travail of what will go on at that time. And there will be all kinds of hardship and yearnings by people, hardship by some, a world turned over by others, and throughout the Gemara we see that this is a kind of concept that comes clear. Umedina shel gehenom, and from the judgment of gehenom. So the concept of gehenom is obviously alive and well at the time of the Gemara, if it's in the Gemara. Your soul moves on to be judged once your bodily death occurs. Gehenom, in different manifestations within the tradition, is a place that has at its core either more or less features, like we conceive of a fiery furnace like hell within Western thought, or it's a waiting station for those souls that don't immediately get their part in Olam Haba, in the world to come. And in the mystical literature, Gehenom is a place where your soul can linger for any number of years, depending on the different sefer, the different book that you read, and it has a certain amount of work to do within that place in terms of getting rid of lichluch hanishama, the soul scum that is acquired as you go through life and you sin and you can't get it scrubbed off by ministering angels when your soul leaves at night and comes back in through your nostrils in the morning, which is part of the Modei Ani experience. That's why you say, thank you God for returning my soul to me in the morning, according to the Zohar, according to the mystical text. So Gehenom, this din by the rabbis, is most likely a place where serious sinners are destined or bound, and they do not get the reward, even though it says in the Mishnah, "L'chol Yisrael yesh chalek ba'olam haba," even though it says to every Jew there's a respite and a portion of the world to come. Rabbis had some concept that certain souls would be stuck in Gehenna their entire existence, and that the more wicked you were in this life and the more reward you got. And we saw this actually when we learned Sanhedrin last semester together, that one of the rabbinic answers about those people is that they're spending up all their zechut, all their merit, and they're spending up all their greatness of the Olam Haba experience in this world, and so when they go to the next world they'll simply be in Gehenna. So you're going to spare yourself if you keep Shabbat. And of course, for that decree, there are certain sins which get you there even faster. So which are the sins you think, you know, get you there faster? For sure, idol worship. For sure.
Number one,
survey says, the idolatrous Jewish person does not inherit Olam Haba. It would be an interesting study to look at how many times, thou shalt not murder is pretty plain, right? and there's lots of there's lots of discussion on what's murder and what's not murder, but idolatry really, really can get you spiritually thrown in the slammer.
Does the order in the Ten Commandments indicate? Because it's number one on that list.
Right. I imagine that for sure the discussion that begins, you shall have no other gods and don't bow down to any others, and idolatrous practice was first among them. I mean, the order of the Ten Commandments can be traced back, of course, to the reality that they're facing this ancient Canaanite reality, divinely created for the moment, and tests for Am Yisrael, if you want to go that way, or sociologically and historically grounded, if you want to go that way. But of course, I think the rabbis picked up on that thread of Torahic thinking, that you cannot go the way of the Canaanite, cannot go the way of these idolatrous nations.
Well, it's written contemporaneously with the golden calf going on.
Really,
it had, there was a need for it.
Right.
Can I just ask about, I'm interested in the scrubbing imagery. Because it sounds very much like karma in Eastern thought. And I was wondering if there were, at that time, connections that might have been made at the time that these notions were developing that relate to Eastern religion.
Yeah. The quick answer on that, Barry, is that there are many studies, several, let's say, that have tried to make evident the connection between Jewish mystical thinking and Far East Buddhist thinking. And there are other studies that have tried to make evident the parallels between Jewish mystical thinking and Sufism, which also has some of that element as well. But nothing absolutely definitive. Nothing absolutely definitive. And that the notion that religious experience in the world can contain similar types of experiential soul, either let's call them pathways, destinies, fates, that's not a surprise by religious phenomenologists. But whether they're really in dialogue with one another is even somewhat doubtful. And what's incredible then, even what's then more incredible, is the observation that you're making, that in certain religious cultures, similar types of religious experience, both for bodies, souls, communities, ultimately are created in studying these as the narratives of a people and their religious habits. So it's not for lack of desire to see if there's any real encounter. And secondly, it's interesting by way of phenomenology in itself. Yeah.
I would like to go back to the sentence itself. Lechevlo shel Mashiach midin Gehenom u'milchemet Gog u'Magog.
Right.
Once the Mashiach comes, there is Tchiyat Amitim. So I don't know why the repeat or the thing, something that's supposed not to happen is happening after the Mashiach. And once the Mashiach comes, there is Erz upon peace, so why there is Mashiach Gog u'Magog? So I don't understand why they put it in that order, and if it's connected at all, because once the Mashiach is here, according to Shlosh Ikarei Emunah, the other two don't exist anymore.
Well, first of all, they don't know about the 13 principles of faith that the Rambam articulated, which are the Yud Gimel Ikarim that Ron just referred to. So push that aside. That's 11th century. This is back now, say, rabbinically. Secondly, the travails of the Mashiach and the judgment of Gehenna and the war of Gog and Magog may all be wrapped up into one.
That's okay. But because they did it as three,
No, but it all may be wrapped up into one with three distinct and unique parts.
Right.
So it could be like one Shabbat has three different meals, so too the experience of the end of days and time has three different pieces. So that's basically that. There's a Mashiach that will overcome Gog u'Magog, the enemy, that will ultimately lead to a judgment for all souls, and whether or not you're really resurrected, it's not so clear that everybody gets that. So if you're linking all that together, it's not surprising that it could come together and that it's not stages. If it is stages, it's an interesting choice of order. You're right. I can't explain it. And what's interesting, though, is that all of them are in some ways about what will happen in the future, and I link my present religiosity to that which will occur in the future, even though I'm delighting in today. And I'm delighting in this cycle of seven and in Habri'ah Atzma. So let me get to the third one as well. The Gemara and preparing for class sent me to interesting reading. Sometimes I make copies for you of journals that I think are the commonly held really good peer-reviewed journals. I was unsure about this one, so I didn't make you the copies. Which peers were reviewing this and how many of them? Okay, so the place, though, that seems to summarize Gog and Magog, one of the best ways, is in this journal, and I would have to go and I want to read another article, but it's in the Evangelical Quarterly. So the Evangelical Quarterly has an introduction about Gog and Magog, and of course we don't really know etymologically where exactly the term comes from. In Bereishit it seems to be that it's two different people, kind of after the long line of idol worshippers and potential then enemies of the Jewish people who will live in the north. In Ezekiel chapters 38-39 it seems to be Gog from the land of Gog, Gog Magog, from the land of Gog. And the summary that this author in the journal presents, Nicholas Railton is his name, he's introducing the history of a symbol. He's introducing it by way of English mythology itself, because he's writing from an evangelical community in England, and that then he's going through the Muslim symbolism with it, and there's much of that, and then the Jewish apocalyptic symbolism of Gog and Magog, which I think you'll find a little you'll find interesting, and you'll find interesting by way of one of the tropes that's in our portion, if you remember, in our section of Gemara, and that is, remember, we couldn't save all of the translations that we wanted because they might have misinformation. Just keep that in mind as I read you a few of the sections here of the summary. Ezekiel's prophecy provided images that sparked the imagination of later Jewish apocalypticists. The Septuagint translation of Numbers 24:7 has Gog instead of Agag as the enemy that will come into play, and adds the name Gog in Amos 7:1, where that was not listed in the original Hebrew text as one of the enemies at that time that the prophet was talking about. Where the locusts would be at Gog's command instead of just a plague of locusts. The oldest Jewish Sibylline text, in other words, the time of what we call the post-canonical Tanakh period and the pre-Mishnaic Talmudic period, where texts that were written are usually the texts that find their way into what we call the Apocrypha, which are the outer extent texts. So they employ the Gog prophecy in its description of the end times. 1 Enoch 56 and 57 interpret Gog as the wild hordes of Parthians and Medes, which at the time were a major threat to Israel. Here we have then one of the earliest equations of the eschatological foe in Ezekiel with the historical enemies of Israel. We think maybe, though, that Ezekiel, in thinking about then in historical terms, if that was the case, was making reference to Babylon, the one nation not listed in chapters 25 to 32. The pre-Christian Silverman books say that the country of Gog and Magog lies between the rivers of Ethiopia, and it will suffer a bloodbath and be called a place of judgment. Satan takes on leadership of Gog and Magog in certain of the books, but Jacob in Genesis Rabbah, Eldad and Medad prophecy about the last battle in the Midrash with Gog, and then the fall of Gog in order for a time of Messiah to come. Pesikta 79a, which is Pesikta Rabati and Pesikta, are two Midrashim in the times of the times of strata in Midrash, can sometimes even predate the Mishnah itself. Pesikta 79a, Gog and Magog's plans are compared with those of Esau and the Pharaoh and Haman, those who wish to exterminate the Jews. In Tanhuma Shoftim, the peoples following Gog are filled with an evil spirit prior to rebelling against King Messiah in the final decisive battle. Mentioned in 2 Esdras, 4 Ezra, 1 and 2 Enoch, Jubilees, and in these translations, as mentioned before, not only was the name Gog, the enemy, added where the Gog enemy wasn't added before, so if you had your translation into Greek, you were thinking that the text said something different and interpreting now anew with this Gog enemy. But Josephus is the first to interpret Gog and Magog as being the contemporary Scythians, a name used by himself and other writers of the time to represent all unknown barbarian peoples inhabiting the north. And he is in tune with Pliny, who say that Alexander had locked up these peoples behind huge gates in the hills north of the Caspian Sea. And remember, for a long, long time, I mean, let's say until Peter the Great, the barbarians and the different groups who are from the Caspian Sea all the way through Russia, you know, rule the lands and think about coming north and finding ports and finding ways to overcome these empires over here to their west. So, interesting that it's taken in that direction, but not surprising. And perhaps, then, in the Gemara, if one was not to make it all about eschatological realities, one could see the War of Gog and Magog as a hidden kind of reference to the war that was going on with any conquerors or would-be conquerors in the current moment and day. So that if it went from one who fulfills the Sabbath is spared the travails of the Messiah, the judgment of Gehenna, you know, in other words, time on this earth that might be different, judgment in terms of soul and afterlife, and then finally the kind of military reality that we might face if we have an enemy really come and try to exterminate us. If it is a veiled reference, like in some of these other books, then it makes it very different than having it all three connected in the way that we said before, as a possibility that it was all about the eschatological reality of what will be. Sabbath as a day to keep that would bring you a taste of the world to come may indeed argue for seeing all these things wrapped up in the world to comeness kind of equation, and not necessarily the kind of military, anti-military warring that might need to go on in order to create a free society. But they're no strangers to double entendre, the rabbis.
So when was the first description of the need for a definitive war before the messianic period comes in?
Well, this is in the Tanakh, in Ezekiel, this is the place. We're unclear exactly on the roots of the tradition, and we're unclear exactly where it goes afterwards. Other than, we do have the texts that I read to you about from the article that summarized them quite nicely. And in messianic terms and what will be in the end of days, you know, let's say that you don't have much of that spelled out outside of a few different chapters in the Gemara. So one is in Sanhedrin, Perek HaChelek, what will happen at the times of the Messiah, how do you know who the Messiah is, what's going to be, will there be a battle, will there not be a battle, the discussions of the Mashiach ben David and the Mashiach ben Yosef, there's a first Messiah, then a second Messiah in our tradition, and one is from the Joseph line, and one is then from the Davidic line. You know, there are discussions, but messianism is, not to be too punny about it, it's messy, because there's no set tradition regarding these wars and who these enemies really are, we don't know.
where, because you're reading from the Evangelical Quarterly.
Yeah.
Where does the Christian idea that the Jews have to be in Israel and be destroyed before the second coming of Christ? How does that...
That's the next article that I didn't get. I'm sorry. It's a good question. Because if one was to go and look at Gog and Magog as being part of that potential, and we don't have the prophets saying what's good and right that we would overcome, and that this battle would be kind of an all-end battle. I'm not really clear. It'd be an interesting investigation textually to see where they bear that from, where that bears out. Yeah.
I can't put my finger on it, I don't remember where I saw it, but I think that in those days, it's an ancient doctrine that the world is cyclical and it comes to an end and then it starts again. And it ends in, you know, one big grim fire and destruction. So that could be those messianic days. It's like the yearning for to be saved from that. Because there is a belief, or there was a belief, that it's all major cyclical, major historical cycles, and that's very ancient. Goes back to
calculating the end of days and saying there are certain amounts of years that will be, and then the world will end. It's definitely
that's in the Talmud.
Definitely,
Talmud.
There's definitely traditions in our tradition. There's a Zoroastrian tradition that it's about 6,000 years, and that there are three epics, and that's obviously a magog, an encounter that the rabbis have culturally. So there's a book by Patai, I believe, called Messianic Speculation in Israel, something along these lines, that goes through a little bit of that. And Dr. David Lieber, who was one of the editors in the Eitz Chaim Chumash, was one of the most rational Jewish thinkers you could ever imagine and encounter when it came to the Psalms, and came to the books of Samuel and Chronicles. He taught the class on Jewish messianism, and loved to get into all these questions about what's going to be.
But it's not. I mean, I thought normative Jewish thinking is not cyclical. That there is time's arrow goes in one direction to the Messiah, and that is the end. Not that there would be anything after the messianic era.
Well, it's interesting that they call that Olam Haba. And that some have a conception of what this post-messianic world will be, and the only holiday we'll celebrate in it, for instance, will be Purim. So there is a vision of what that post-messianic time will include, and people like Yosef Alba, who wrote the Ikarim, the five pillars, things like this, two mystical texts to some midrash, have pictures, but that's an investigation into the texts that...
But that's
includes
then
a
forever,
look.
Right?
Yeah.
Then nothing happens.
Right. It may not be as cyclical. You're right.
It doesn't start again, because the way you describe it sounds like the Big Bang.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that it goes like this.
No. Big Bang is linear, but I'm talking about cyclical.
Yeah.
The world being destroyed and starting again on a major historical cycle, beyond historical cycle.
So that sounds like the Big Bang. But Jewish ideas, I thought... get to the Messianic era, and that's it in perpetuity.
Let's say we have to investigate further to see exactly what the various traditions present. But for sure there's a time of Mashiach, and then not another time of Mashiach. You know, that Mashiach will come and there'll be a Olam Haba.
Well, I'm just going to point out, thousands of years earlier in Mesopotamia, they're counting time differently. So they're counting time either by kingdom, I'm sorry, by king reign, and then time ends and has to start again, or even within a king's reign, they're counting it year by year by what happens in that year. So they do not have a concept of a linearity or a progression. It is a cycle. Something else has to come after this one. Either that, or they think it's going to end with that one. But since they have their own records of subsequent kings written down, it's seems to me that they do believe in some form of cycle. It's not... I think there must be a long history to this thought of how you look at time.
For
that
sure.
Is, that way predates Ezekiel. And that we're hearing that influence, but we can't yet know what that influence really is. It's not just a Jewish thought.
Well, the notion of capturing any sense of the cycles in our lives is not major ages turning one to the next, except for the Mashiach question and Shabbat. So moving it back down to home, the rabbis are trying to give us some sense of why we would attach ourselves to these things in a spiritual kind of bigger picture of the world, but make your cycle of every 7 days connected into great ends and goodness for you within this life. And what makes for a good life and with whom and how is now the next part of the Gemara. So let's encounter what the texts say. Okay, so the Gemara is going to adduce a scriptural proof for each of the things that it brings us to, and that is Michevlo Shel Mashiach. He's spared from the travails of the Mashiach, as it's written, Ketiv Hacha Yom. It's written here in regard to Sabbath meals day, meaning the verse that I brought us back to before in Shemot, right? Once it's written day, and it's written there in regard to the advent of the Messiah. Hine Anochi Shalech Lachem Et Eliyahu Anavi Lifnei Bo Yom. Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet before there arrives the day of Hashem, great and awesome. Remember, Elijah is going to be not the Mashiach himself. Elijah, in our tradition, is the messenger that says, Hayom Ba, here's the day it's coming, that all will be different from here on because Mashiach is on his way. Medina shel Gehenom, that is, he's spared from the judgment of Gehenom. It's derived like this, Ketiv Hachayom, it's written here, day, where's the here, where's the Hacha? In Shemot, in our verse that had the three mentions of the word day. And there it's written, Uchetiv Hatam, Yom Evra Ayomahu, and it's written there in regard to Gehenom, a day of anger is that day, and in, that is Tzfanya. Milchem Gog Magog, that he's spared from the war of Gog Magog is deduced as follows: Ketiv Hachayom, it's written here day, Uchetiv Hatam Beyom Bo Gog, and it's written there on the day Gog comes. So we've learned them each from this. If it means day over here by way of the Sabbath meal, and I can connect myself to the Sabbath meal and know that A, I have a halachic requirement to have three of them because it mentioned it three times, and I can also now have an overlay of some greater spiritual or kind of Jewish thought, Machshevet Yisrael kind of level of to my Shabbat meal, I now link myself to these two levels very easily. I'm fulfilling the command of the Torah, and since the Torah said those things three times, and I link it to the words Hayom in the three verses regarding these matters, obviously these three meals have this kind of counterbalance to these travails or misfortunes that might approach in life. The teaching regarding the reward for feasting on the Sabbath then goes further. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Yossi, Kol ha-me'aneget ha-shabbat notnim lo nachala bli mitzarim. If you celebrate the Sabbath day, you're granted a boundless inheritance or heritage, as it says, Shene'emar, Az tit'anag al Adonai ve'hirkavticha al bomote'er aret v'ha'achalticha nachalat Yaakov Avicha. It says, if you'll get this great heritage or inheritance, if you proclaim the Sabbath a delight, then you shall be granted pleasure with God, and I shall mount you astride the heights of the world, and I will provide you the heritage of your forefather, Jacob. So, what's fascinating here is two things. One, just a note on translation again, because we like to compare now that we have Rabbi Steinsaltz's project, the new Koren Talmud, and also the art school in front of us. So let's see if it says the same thing. Rabbi Yochanan reported in the name of Rabbi Yossi, whoever delights in the Sabbath is granted a boundless heritage. Rabbi Yochanan says, in the name of Rabbi Yossi, with regard to anyone who delights in Shabbat, God gives him a boundless portion. So what in terms of English words is different about heritage and portion? Nice, could be that portion.
One is forward and one is back.
One seems like back and one seems forward. See, that to me also stuck out. Heritage seems to me to be that you're going to be part of a long line of tradition and you're going to have this kind of heritage in the world, and it could be the long line that then grants you permission to actually live on a land or not, like Rashi says about the word heritage in this way, nahala, that it's the heritage of having a land created just for you, promised to your people, and then you'd have it. But the portion, the word portion, is an interesting kind of piece, and Steinsaltz's note says the following, a boundless portion, nachala bli mitzarim. The reward of a boundless portion is one that is measure for measure. Since one delights in Shabbat without limiting his expenditures, one is rewarded with a portion that is limitless. So it seems like he's taking it down to the level of if you know, really are going to now... Yeah, it seems like that's what he's saying, and he's quoting the Beit Yosef, who is Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's writing halachic codes in the 16th century, but before that, who writes a compendium of commentary on the code that was produced two centuries before him called Arba'a Torim by Rabbi Yaakov Ben Asher. And the Beit Yosef is the larger version of the Shulchan Aruch. Basically, the Beit Yosef is the longer version of the Shulchan Aruch. And it's published a century before the Shulchan Aruch is published. And he's saying that you got to spend some money on Shabbat. So don't worry if you're spending a little bit of money on Shabbat and you're getting a little bit tight during the week. So the boundless portion for him is a little bit having to do with the economics and the life of a stam person who's trying to make ends meet, as opposed to the complete portion of the world to come, if that's what nachalat can mean to you, or even a heritage by way of history and connection to a Sabbath tradition. The Gemara proceeds to cite the verse from Isaiah, which speaks of one who delights in Shabbat as being rewarded with the portion of Jacob. Some commentators explain that the portion of Abraham was shared with the descendants of Ishmael and Lot, and part of Isaac's portion was given to Esau. However, the portion of Jacob was complete, not shared with others, and therefore boundless by way of the Jewish connection. So, this is a piece that Yaakov becomes, in essence, our portion in the world instead of Abraham or Isaac. Again, if we were teasing that out more, we
I'd be a West Side, I'd be a settler on the West Bank with that statement.
Oh, maybe. But what's interesting about that quip is that listen to where the Gemara goes by way of now linking it to the question of, are you talking about my inheritance of the land of Israel? Why these Middle Ages commentaries that Steinsaltz just quoted and translated for us seem to indicate that it's talking about the great portion of land, while others went elsewhere. Abraham's descendants had to have some, and Yitzhak's descendants had to have some. Therefore, it's purely ours when you really talk about Yaakov. Listen to where the Gemara goes, though, as opposed to that. So, goes from there. So what's this portion of Yaakov? Interesting to say portion of Yaakov. It didn't say portion of Abraham. It didn't say portion of Yitzchak. Lo Avraham shekatuv bo kum hitalech ba'aretz l'orka. It's not written like Avraham's portion regarding the verse, arise and go and walk about the land through its length and breadth and inherit the land. It's not written like that. Nachalat Yaakov is not hachelek v'hanachalat shel Avraham. It's not the portion and the part and the inheritance of Abraham. V'lo cheyitzchak shekatuv, and it's not like Isaac's inheritance either. That's written hatuv bo. That's written like this: ki lecha ulezaracha eten et kol ha'aratzot ha'el. Regarding about whom it is written, for to you and your offspring I will give these lands. Rather, what? Eilech Yaakov shekatuv bo. Rather, it's written about Yaakov, the inheritance you're going to receive. Ufaratzta yama v'kedmat v'tzafon v'negba. and you spread out westward, eastward, northward, and southward, meaning without any limit or border. Now, the note goes back into the Beit, who we said was originally the Beit Yosef, and quotes a Hasidic master who says, "One who delights in the Sabbath is paid back measure for measure, just as he spends his funds for the Sabbath without restraint, so too he's granted the inheritance without restriction." And that cites the Beit Yosef, but also Sfat Emet. "One who delights in the Sabbath is likely to be one who sees God as the source of his sustenance, for one who believes that it is his labors and efforts alone that generate his income tends to view the Sabbath as an intrusion upon his money-making activities. Such a person's confidence is placed in his own finite abilities, and thus the portion given him is finite. On the other hand, a person who labors because that is God's will is overjoyed at the arrival of the Sabbath. His confidence is placed in the infinite, and so his portion will be infinite as well." So, you could say that by the time they get to Yaakov, that it's Yama Vakevna Tafona Vanegba, that it's all about the land in and of itself. Or you could say that in the sense that they really went in all those directions, even outside the land, the children of Yaakov, to go find their sustenance in Eretz Mitzrayim, to go find their sustenance when there are droughts at times that they needed to, that it could be looked at that way. Of course, there are those who are true to the Peshat of the verse, which means Yama Vakemas Fon of Anegba is really the inheritance of the land of Israel. But one could possibly go that way with the story of Yaakov. Oh, Jeff?
It's very interesting that on Shabbat, when we celebrate Yom Shabbat, we are taking a militant sentence from the Bible, Uparatzta. Paratzta is very militant.
What does that mean?
Paratzta is to break in. It's many other bits in there.
It's also just to multiply, though.
It's very, because the other two is when Abraham walked the land, it's very peaceful, and when Isaac, God gives you. So it's a gift of God. Here, Uparatzta. So it's a very militant argument that is a reward of Shabbat. It's very interesting that it's all together. Now, I don't know if it's connected only to the land of Israel, because they said, Yama Vaked Matzafon Avanegba. Yama is immediately the Mediterranean. It could be the other side. So it's not really connected to
our... I'm saying if you interpreted it at the widest level.
Yeah, but it's very militant.
No, I don't really... I would have to do more of a philological look at what Uparatzta...
It's
all right, so let's say that that's an open question. Let's say it's an open question how violent that root is in the Bible.
So when you first talked about not Abraham, not Isaac, but Jacob, I was thinking that they were talking about the progeny, that Jacob is the one that had so many children, his 12 sons. So when they say portion, they really mean land. They don't necessarily mean portion could be, the multiplication of your family, of your generations.
This is why people should have Gemaras of their own, so that they write their own commentaries, Bobby. It's a nice commentary of Nachala, of what an inheritance is and a portion is.
And you just said that Paratz or whatever has something to do with what it's...
Burst forth, like, right, that the population should burst forth.
Yeah, so I'm wondering whether...
Yeah.
That
I like that connotation more than the violent one, for sure. Okay, let's push forward.
the most interesting thing about Judaism that's never really talked about is the confinement of the land. That the land to inherit, it isn't the vision of taking over the entire world. It's not like any other imperial power. All imperial powers sought control of all the land. Judaism, from its origin, had a very defined and very limited geographic domain, which I think is underappreciated as a mindset, because it also implies that there are non-Jews in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The exception of Elena, but basically the Jewish religion is conceived of in the context of a non-Jewish world that's very big, that we don't have to worry about, and we don't have to aspire to take over.
Well, remember, Elenu picks up on threads of thought in Isaiah and the other prophets that says one day Jerusalem will be the center of the world, and God's Torah and God's law will spread out to all the nations.
But I think Elenu is very different than what I interpret the Torah to be oriented to it.
I think we trust that one day it will be God and God's center as Jerusalem that will answer that. Maybe by way of we didn't want to be imperialist and we're not so colonial. Maybe because we are a small people and that's the buildup of theology and an attitude that goes along with our being that much of a portion of the world's population. But I do agree that it could be looked at deeper, you know, in terms of the prevailing attitude and why.
But it's very different to be a light to the nations than to be the conqueror of the nations.
Right, right.
Actually, if I may, I'm struck by your point about the limitness of Israel in terms of the land and that would be inherited. I never really thought about it that way, but I'm reminded at the same time we were talking about, as an aside, the song of Barata, which Rabbi Wexler had sung after the massacre in Mumbai, and it had to do with Chabad. And the song of Barata and Sprat, I think it was a song that you would sing. Do you remember this? Does anyone remember? The point was, of Barata had to do with sprouting, like Chabad crops up all over the place, not just in Eretz Israel. So I don't know if there's any connection there.
Well, that's the connection that I am making with the larger interpretive force of the verse, not just being about Yamakim Atzfon V'Negba as the land of Israel in and of itself and only there. So that is really it. I'm glad that the experience came in another way. That this verse, really at its core, indeed could say that we go far beyond as a people within the world. And if you're saying it because the Jews had a center in Mumbai and the Jews had a center in one or another places and we were feeling connected in our portion.
Being unstoppable, that the point he made, if I remember the drops, that there was, that the Chabad houses all over would not be suppressed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. No, it's a nice connection to that spirit of the interpretation of this verse, and that's the verse. That's the verse. So let's push forward. We're on 118b1 still on the left-hand side. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak Amar. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak says, Nitzol mishibud galuyot. He's spared from the oppression of the exiles. Ketiv hacha v'hir kav ticha al bumatei aretz. It's written here concerning the one who's celebrating the Sabbath. And I shall mount you astride the heights of the world. Uchetiv hatam v'ata al bumatei mo tidrocha. And it's written there, but you'll trample upon the haughty ones in their kind of places. So if you've called the Sabbath a delight, you are in essence doing that which the prophet said, trampling on the places. And by the way, you didn't need to do it through the militaristic fashion. Because again, the notion of Shabbat and Shabbat being the protector and the Shabbat being the one that advances the cause of the vision even, when God says you'll overcome enemies, is at the core of your keeping Sabbath and Sabbath meals. Another benefit. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Kol ha-me'aneg et ha-shabbat notnin lo mishalot libo. Whoever delights in the Sabbath is granted his heart's wishes. Shenemar, as it said, Ve'hit aneg al Hashem, Ve'yitain lecha mishalot libecha. As it says in the Psalms, and you take delight in Hashem, and Hashem will grant your heart's wishes. Oneg ze'eno yodea mahu. Now, I don't know what is meant by delight. However, when it says, and you'll call the Sabbath a delight, I would say that refers to the delight of the Sabbath. The Gemara defines now the requirement, what's the Sabbath delight that I have to have? with what do I delight in the Sabbath? How do I find delight there? And you see that the translation over here already inserted the word idiomatically foods, because that's the nature of the passage that's going to come. Over here, he says, the question is translated, I don't know what it is. When it says, and you shall call the Sabbath delight, one must say it's the delight of the Sabbath. And the Gemara asks in a general way, with what does one delight in the day of Shabbat? So if I was only using a translation here that already inserted the idiomatic word foods, and it kind of assumes that the reading ahead is the only read of the Gemara, then I'm going to answer, here are the foods that you use for the delight of the Sabbath, and in a second we're going to get there. But if I don't use a translation, and I'm reading Gemara in translation, well, with what do I delight in on the Sabbath? Couldn't that leave the question a little bit more open? So again, my point with translation. Is that clear? Okay, let me go back. If I have to delight in the Sabbath and I'm going to get my heart's wishes, and I have a verse that says, what's meant by delight? It means v'karat al-shabbat oneg, that I call my Sabbath a delight, and therefore the delight of the Sabbath is parallel to the delight in God that then fulfills my heart's desires. And I would say that this refers to the delight of Shabbat. And comes along somebody who says, oh, you guys are talking about the delight of Shabbat? Maze ha'onek shel Shabbat? What's the oneg of Shabbat? What's the delight of the Sabbath? That's a different question then. If you have heart's desires, you're going to get good. And if you have Sabbath desire, that's the way you do God's portion of desiring God's portion and delighting in God's portion. And your heart's going to be fulfilled. And by the way, what foods do I need to make a Sabbath delight happen? I'm already assuming in a certain translation or a certain providing my, or, you know, kind of asking my question, what are the foods I need to do this? But if I didn't have a the rest of the Gemara and I was just experiencing the discussion, the discussion might be after one is told to go have a Sabbath oneg, delight in the Sabbath. How do I delight in the Sabbath? That could be a much more open question. That's my only point about what's going on in the translation. If I may just...
Is the word oneg usually used with food, and therefore
oh,
the,
should think that? So I don't know that the oneg is only used with food. What's that?
For them.
Yeah, perhaps for them if we go through systemically and look at the where it's used. But there's also other tanugim on Shabbat as well. And there are other delights of Shabbat. And I just pointed out, by the way, it's just a little bit of a translation issue that sometimes for readers, if you want the unfolding story, sometimes it's nice to just have the words translated plainly without the entire inclusion of what's to come peppering the translation. Meanwhile, it does mean here, food. And I'm going to now get an answer about food that helps me delight in the Sabbath. And Rav Yehuda, the son of Rav Shmuel Bar Shila, said in the name of Rav, "B'tavshil shel taradin v'dagim gedolim v'roshei shumin," with a dish of cooked beets, large fish, and cloves of garlic, or crowns of garlic. I like better than cloves of garlic. Okay, so, Rav Chiya Bar Ashi Amar Rav, and Rav Chiya Bar Ashi said the name of Rav, "Afilu davar mu'at v'lichlot Shabbat asa'o." If one's funds are scarce, then even if he prepares something small, but he does so really in honor of the Sabbath, Hare ze oneg, that's considered an oneg. Mahi, what is that? What's an example of that? Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa said, kasid da harsana, and if you look at the note, it says small fish fried in their own oils and flour. Small pieces of fish with a little bit of flour on them. So, fish schnitzel. So, what's beautiful about this passage, of course, is that you get a real sense of what's going on at their tables. What's really happening, and it's not meat. That's exactly one of the points that a lot of people write about this as what is the first place to really have Tanug Shel Shabbat defined, and here the answer is fish. Fish is really among the top categorical dishes of oneg Shabbat that you get right from the Gemara. And just to mention the other two for a minute, beets are a common root vegetable of the day, and there are lots of different types. Some we have today, some we do not have today. Some are sweeter, some are less. Some you can pickle, some you cannot. They probably mean a kind of a roasted beet, according to some of the food historians that I've read in terms of the dish here. And there's a way to cook the beet greens in addition to the beets themselves. I don't know if anybody's had beet salad by Moroccans before, but it's a wonderful sliced up beet salad with all the greens put in, and it's either very spicy or it's not spicy, depending on who you want to cook it for, and it's got some great olive oil. It's a lovely dish that continues, they say, all the way back from Talmudic times. It's a real Talmudic tradition.
We should have some on
Saturday for lunch. Yeah, we might. And they also have a tradition with fish. Crowns of garlic. I don't know if you've ever seen a Shabbat table that has these. You have to declare garlic amnesty before this actually becomes part of what you eat. But you slice off the top of a whole clove, and you roast it in the oven, and you serve the sweet and savory and beautiful garlic kind of paste that comes after you squeeze them out, and you have it on challah, or you eat it just as some people just like to eat it. And we used to do this in Jerusalem. We used to buy rows and rows and rows and put a whole, if you will, kind of casserole, I guess you call it, dish or something like this to the size, and have, you know, 16 to 20 to 24 of these and roast them in the oven before the whole house, literally. I mean, garlic. It's the Ashkenazic Jewish members of the community would flock, and Sfardim, because of the fish with the harif, with the pepper. And we would leave a door open, and by the third meal, when we were serving all those and keeping them warm, literally people would just come for a little bit of a taste of that and make a mizonot. They would bless mizonot on a little cracker that we had on a table. And it was a time that we had literally a door open for the third meal of Shabbat in the neighborhood Nachlaot, near the open market in Jerusalem. And it was, talk about tanuk shows. That was, depending on the day, you could have sudash lishit anywhere like between 4 o'clock in the afternoon, or let's say the later Shabbat in the summer. First meal Shabbat night on Friday, right. Second is lunch, and depending on what time you have morning prayers, you know, in the community I'm talking to you about now, you could be done with prayers by 9:15 in the morning, have your meal, have enough to really go to sleep for an hour or two, go back to synagogue for an afternoon class in some type of Jewish law or some type of Bible commentary. You'd sit and walk through Jerusalem. People would go for this or that. There are other things that you can still learn. And then there would be mincha, and people would either stay and make these Sudas Lishit experiences at the synagogue itself, because there's a classic kind of model of having mincha and the third meal of Shabbat and then a Maariv service with Havdalah at a synagogue. But sometimes they'd have an earlier mincha, the day was really long, and you can go back and have an extended third meal yourself at your place, and then go back to the synagogue for the last service of the day and Havdalah. Fish, all over every neighborhood in different forms, comes to be a very essential ingredient in the Jewish diet and on the Shabbat table. And so when you think of fish for the Shabbat table, what do you think of? Okay, gefilte fish. Maybe herring. Herring I associate more with the third meal than I associate with the Friday night gefilte fish. In the Moroccan culture, it's some type of carp or whiting, and it's cut like this down the fish after everything is deboned. And it's made, you can see like the kind of fillet, it's like when you cut the salmon with the two flanks, and you cook it with peppers and cilantro and very hot peppers, and that's a very popular, common Moroccan fish. In the Iranian culture, they have a fish that's similar to that Moroccan dish, but it has lots of zests of lemon and also some cilantro and some very spicy kind of peppers. And no, that's Hungarian mostly, right? That's the Ashkenazic world. Anyhow, the notion of eating fish on Shabbat is a widespread and commonly known custom and Jewish law even in some places. And there's an entire article in this book by Moshe Chalamish called HaKabbalah, the received tradition, not just Kabbalah proper as in capital K and the genre. The received tradition, because the word Kabbalah is used all over the Gemara, right, and it means received tradition. But tefillah b'halacha v'minhag. So the received.
Can I guess?
What's that?
Can I guess why fish is good?
Yeah, why?
Because it wasn't destroyed in the flood, so it wasn't evil.
Right. That's absolutely it.
That's a good one.
There's also the blessing that we talked about on Shabbat. If you were here, I talked about the blessing of Jacob. And he said, "Vayid gula rov bekerav aretz," and you'd multiply like the fish all throughout the land. And so the notion that we appreciate the plentifulness of Jewish life and culture and community throughout the land becomes symbolic in terms of the fish we eat. So that's one reason. Okay, so ultimately, from a social standpoint, fish can be among the cheaper items that one could buy and make special for the day. Of course, there are super expensive fish that you can pay an arm and a leg for beyond what you pay for meat these days. Right. Heluoto al shulchan milachim. They put it on tables of kings, the aniyim ke'echad, and of those who had very little, all the same. Hakol lefi ha'efsherut ha'kaspit. Everything was because of the possibility they had on an economic level in order to get such fish. And gastronomit. And because it's... And ultimately that it was a gastronomic delicacy. Now, v'chach atamotzei yisod shel onek Shabbat v'achilat agim b'Shabbat. Therefore, you find that it's very, very much the basis of the delight of the Sabbath. Afidu ad kedei midah shel mesirut nafesh, until or nefesh, that it brings you over to kind of put your to feel connected on a soul level. On the level of bringing yourself to the recognition that you are someone who respects Shabbat so deeply, like Yosef Shayamokir Shabbat. And what is that story? It's a story that Hayam Mechabed Shabbatot V'Yamim Tovim Kol Kach. This Yosef, who was so, so dedicated to keeping Sabbath and Yontif in his life, and found the great jewels that he needed to find all kinds of riches so that forever he would afford fish on every Sabbath, even though he gave away in one story all of his belongings and all of what somebody else needed for the Sabbath, or in another story, this he becomes a character, a demud, a typos, a type in several sources, and of course there's the classic Gemara about him. There's Af ro'im anu ki niftach minag, that in different areas there became a very, very prevalent custom. By the way, no one here should feel obligated as I read this. Mishloach l'rav Makom, to send to the rabbi of the community, dagim b'matana lichot Shabbat, to send fish over to the rabbi's house to celebrate Shabbat. Ule'itim ak goyim nahagu b'chach, and sometimes even the non-Jews of the community would send the fish to the rabbi. Now, gefilte fish.
Wait, before you go there, just think about Jesus and the fish and the loaves. Mm-hmm. And just think of how deep this is held by so many cultures. Right?
Yeah.
Jesus creates infinite numbers of fish and loaves, right? To feed the people. And it's as simple as the fish, right? So the fish has tremendous resonance with you. And Jay made the point, fish have a lot of eggs. So another point of fecundity.
Right, right.
But they were all people who lived near water.
Yeah, and I think that was the first count.
Civilization at that time lived near water.
Right, well, I think that's the starting
point. All civilization at that time lived near water, otherwise it's not.
But it was interesting to see how it appears in different cultures.
I want to bring us to the Lower East Side. Moshe Feinstein was Edison Sivta, downtown. If you've ever been there, it's a fantastic place to go learn and sit.
What's the name of the place?
Sivta.
It's not Rosendorf.
Sivta, Tiferes Yisrael, is it? So the Rav Feinstein's yeshiva is down on the Lower East Side, and it's just by short notice, the Masivta. And anyway, Rav Moshe Feinstein mitzayen et adag kamachal muvhak shel oneg v'hana'a. He says that the fish is indeed a great symbol of delight. Gam im hu l'chol echad kefi yecholto. It's something that everybody can get according to his own wherewithal. Shezel kiseda hal sana l'oni. It's also, you know, something that the poor can afford. V'tavshil shel and ultimately you have these kind of roast beets and fish that come together for the rich. But there's a principle that the founder of Chabad said about this whole enterprise of fish eating. Kol makom makom lefi minhago ya'angu. B'ma'achalim u'mashkim ha'chashuvim lahem ze oneg. So what we see, though, is that there's a little bit of a further definition by Shneur Zalman Milaudeh, the founder of Chabad Hasidism. Says every place in the world will have, according to its own custom, the way to make an oneg Shabbat happen according to the food items and the drink that is local to the Sfat. That there happens to be in Chabad Hasidism a lot of mystical writings, and of course the founding book, the Tanya, but there's also the very practical Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Shulchan Aruch of the Rabbi, meaning the founding Rebbe of that movement, and no, it was before Rav Shneur Zalman from Laude, that's really the founder, and he wrote this halachic compendium, renamed it the Shulchan Aruch, like the 16th century one, but here we were in the 9th, in when he wrote it, the 18th century, and he writes the Halachic compendium. And he says, you're going to be able to define it that way. Now, last piece for the evening, and then take any questions. Berurim Hilchatiim. You're right, and that's the last piece for the evening. Achilat Hadag Orera gam she'elot hilchatiyot misuyamot. So there are halachic questions that come up about the eating of fish. We reintroduced the 39 categories of labors that are forbidden on Shabbat, and we stay clear of those forbidden categories of work. Hotzaat atzamot hadag she'enan reuyot lema'achal achzura mita'am malechet borer. So anyone who's really serious about not doing the malacha, the categorical labor of separation, would not start with the fish on his or her plate, taking out the bones from the get-go, and would only chew them through, and by the way, this is what you do if you're really interested in keeping this level, you kind of you put the bone like this, and you take the bone even out of your mouth, because you can't eat it, it's not ra'ui le'achol. But since that would become a problem, and people we would know, we wouldn't want them to, God forbid, choke, and we have to remove them from danger, and we have a problem with ultimately going that far all the time, what's that really then beget? L'fichach me'etz Reb Chaim מי שחננו השם באושר יכול לקנות בערב שבת דגים ויוציא השדרה כדי שלא יהיה בורר, וגם אידך גיסא בדגים קטני קטנים שאין רגילים להוציא ויוצא מידי פיקפוק. You can get ones that's easy to take the backbone out, or you can get little ones that you can just eat the whole fish right down the hatch, make, you know, like fish soup out of it or something like that. By the way, I went to one Shabbat dinner like that, where there's a bowl of soup, we had some noodles, and then these little fish, I mean, like eyes and all, looking up at you. You know? And zeu ayesod kanirei lahachanat, zeu ayesod kanirei lahachanat gefilta fish. And this is the basis for having prepared gefilta fish. Bechol mekomot shel ta'anug shel gefilta, in all the places where they had the delight of Shabbat wrapped up in gefilta fish. Gefilta, in this case, and there's a discussion. You often hear that, but it really, they say, means mashed. And mashed and ground and made in, you know, made into this ball. Now, the made into the ball part, I'm not sure, but mashed and...
No, it used to be stuffed. It used to be stuffed.
What you eat is the stuffing.
Right.
You made
it
in
fried. That's how
it
is.
Right.
They mine.
I was at a restaurant in Safat and we ordered gefilte fish. And it came, the entire fish, stuffed with what I would consider the gefilte, with the bones on the outside.
I mean, the reason why they say that it means stuffed and that it's inside that fish that you either use the whiting, the carp, the pike, is because that's cooking the fish in more of its own oils, and they needed the skin to do that, and it protected the fish inside, which was now your stuffing or your gefilte ball, from ovens that were not like our ovens today, right? You needed something to protect it, so it was a nice protection. You didn't have foil. But the reality is that might be the word, right? You can, but there are those who bake it, by the way. So, and that too. So, let's say that philological debate is open too. Last piece. I passed around the books because these are our Shabbos benchers. They're called benchers because benching in Yiddish is praying, and they're called birkonim in Hebrew. This is a birkon. It's that in which you find a bracha, so you have a birkon. And the song that I wanted to call your attention to is 28, page 28. And of course it says, Ma yedidut menuchatech, how beloved is your rest, day of Sabbath we're talking about, at Shabbat HaMalka, you're the Shabbat Queen, Bechen narutz lekratech, and thusly we're going to run towards you, Boi chala nesucha, come anointed bride, Lavush bigdech hamudot, will get in fine clothing, Lahadlik ner bivracha, will light the candle with a bracha, Batechel kol avodot, and we'll finish all of our work, Lo tasu melacha, or kol bo melacha, depending on which version of the song you have, we're not going to do any of the categories of labor, and then it says, Lehit aneg, from the root oneg, delight, Beta'anugim, it's a time to delight in all kinds of pleasures. Barburim uslav vedagim, fatted geese, quail, and fish. So, we didn't see fatted geese and quail in the Gemara thus far. We didn't see meat, per se, though we do have a line that we always know in the back of our heads that Ein simcha ela babasar, there's no joy except for that with meat. But this song put out the notion that you have Lehit Aneg B'Tanugim, and since we have just 2 minutes left, how many tunes do we know for this song, right? That's the game Jewish people play around a Shabbat table. We know, Ma Yedidut Menuchatech At Shabbat Amalka B'chein Narutz Likratech Bo'ichala Nesucha Levush big day, hamudot, ein, nein, 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 le hadlik ner, bivracha, ein, nein, 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 vetechel kolabodot, ein, nein, 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 lotasu melacha, ein, nein, 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 le hitaneg, betanugim, baburim, uslavedagim, le hitan, now repeat. The next one, that's the more popular one, which is the one often done here.
Come on, Jay.
Somebody will help me out. Ma yedidut menuchatech ad shabbat hamalkah v'chein narutz likratech boichala nesucha levush bigdech amudot ladlik ner bivacha v'techel kol avodot lo tasu melacha ay 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 na 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 ay na 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 leitaneg betanugim barburim uslavedagim leitaneg betanugim barburim uslavedagim. It keeps going. So the songs themselves, many, many Shabbat table songs, go through and try to teach people in general terms what some of the laws of the Sabbath really are and what they're about. And the more that you interpret the songs and the more you talk about the songs at the table, which people have traditions to do, to sing them and then take one stanza and say, okay, how do we understand that halakha or that tradition? What are we going to do for Shabbat? What are we going to do to increase our connection to this stanza? The more they did that, the more that commentaries around the songs were created, and leads to all kinds of literature about the Sabbath table songs that looks a little bit, you know, typically like regular either prayer books with commentary look, or books with commentary that we might think of, Mishnah or other kinds of things. And the collected compendiums are coming out now more than ever as we have more and more of an interested reading crowd, and books have become a little less expensive to print, but a very serious collection of commentaries from the world of Hasidic masters here, along with Rishonim, Middle Ages commentators who were just encountering these songs for the first time and arguing about whether or not they were right. Final word for the evening is, don't you think that there wasn't a machloket about this song and whether or not Jews could sing this song, because, you know, fat and quail and this kind of thing, really they wanted to keep the dagim. And then even fast forward beyond that, certain songs were used to market not only the rabbinic ideas, but local fishmongers also wanted to have their say, right? And other people. And so you had all kinds of discussions arise out of these ways of continuing along our traditions that ultimately reflect the Talmudic injunction here in our Gemara to eat fish to make your Sabbath a delight.
Can you talk about the next week?
Okay, so let's talk schedule.